Members of the subcommittee, you have before you the original bill which would prohibit school districts from budgeting for ending unreserved fund balances of greater than a certain percent of the total budget, and that percent is not indicated in the bill. There's actually a blank. You also have before you dash two amendments to the bill, which basically replace the original bill and would simply require a school district board to adopt a policy that specifies the percentage or percentage range of the general fund ending balance that the district may carry over to the next fiscal year. The district would not be able to, or the board would not be able to change the policy during the year for which it has adopted the policy. They would have to include the policy with certain public budget documents, explain to the Department of Education when certain variances from the policy occur, and then ODE would have to put budgetary information explanatory statements on its website.
Senator Courtney and Representative Barnhart, would you please come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm state representative from House District 11, and I'm here today to support some amendments to Senate Bill 1053. During the time since this bill was originally contemplated and I think filed, there have been a number of conversations about ways in which we could accomplish some of the goals of the original bill by establishing requirements that would increase transparency in school budgeting. And essentially the idea is to require school boards to adopt policies that would establish limits, establish their understanding of what their ending fund balances ought to be in, as a percentage of their total budget. Many school boards already do this. By the way, the school board that I was on in Eugene established a goal, a target of 5% of their operating budget as a reasonable ending fund balance, and when it fell substantially below that amount, the board got very worried, and I think for good reason. The other area that was of interest, I think, was when boards adopt budgets. The budgets, of course, contain a number of details that are designed to inform the public and, of course, give in guidance to the superintendent and the other administrators in the district what expenditures are expected to be made, and of course it establishes expenditures for wages and for a whole variety of other things that districts normally do. So one of the things that the bill does would establish a requirement that should the budget, should the actual expenditures vary significantly, and we chose 10% as a significant variance, then as a part of the next budget process, the board, probably the superintendent, would need to explain why it was that the budget item varied by that much. That's the essence of the bill. I think the third point is that the Department of Education would then post these explanations along with the other budget material on the website so that information was available. And of course the committee knows that this was all triggered by a poorly researched article that appeared in the Statesman Journal in which schools were accused of keeping an inordinately large ending fund balance, when the reality was that the ending fund balance was made, the large ending fund balances that school districts carried forward at the end of the 04 school year were made necessary by the inverted nature of our budgeting process because of the failure of Measure 30. There was more money in the school district's 03-04 budgets than there were in their 04-05 budgets because of active actions of the legislature. School districts very prudently and reasonably kept extra large ending fund balances at the end of the 04 year and spent the money in the 05 year, as of course, as being prudent managers, they should have done. The newspaper missed that last point, and the article, I think, would have been written very differently had the reporter understood that issue. This simply, in the idea of this bill is to increase transparency and to require districts to be explicit about what it is that they're doing.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Barnhart? Seeing none. Mr. President, Senator Courtney, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devin, and members of the Senate Special Committee on Budget, Subcommittee on Education, Senator Walker, Senator Nelson, Senator Gordley, Senator Whitson. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodburn and the territory in between. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1053. Let me put a little different spin here to my good colleague that I brought with me. Let me allow that a newspaper article appeared in April, which in effect laid out the reserves that school districts had been maintaining going back several years, and the reserve appeared to be, depending upon your perspective, extremely high, both in terms of amounts and percentages, when you consider that our class size have been increasing, teacher salaries have been frozen and or laid off, and they themselves are being laid off, in addition to some of the other issues that we have facing with this involving our school districts. And so there was some discussion about what was going on, and I, the good representative has explained to you, and he is a former school board member. I am not. I serve in the Salem City Council. I never served on a school board. And I want to state that I think any district in this state is constantly shortchanging students in order to preserve opportunities for tomorrow's student. I don't believe that's going on. I simply do not believe that any school district is doing that. The issue is more complicated than that. There are very good reasons for a district to carry large reserve funds. We have experienced a recent recession, and school funding at the state level has been unstable and unpredictable. I cannot fault a school district for trying to be prudent by keeping a healthy or above normal reserve in order to weather the storm. In addition, carrying a large reserve may be the best way for a district to prepare for a major capital project. The way a local district chooses to spend its money is largely a local governance issue. But in order to promote accountability, we must ensure that local districts are following processes that enable their constituents to understand what they're doing. Enter Senate Bill 1053. Now, as I originally wrote the bill, they would place a cap on the amount of reserves the district can carry forward. And the first person in my office was the good representative to my right who completely took my head off and blew up my office and tried to ruin my life because he explained to me he had been on a school board. And he said, Peter, I can tell you that this isn't going on, etc. I said, well, let's talk. Let's talk about it. And I grew to learn that he was right in terms of the simplicity of the original tone of Senate Bill 53. It was too simple. It was too simple to simply say there will be a cap. It's not fair to the school districts, the schools. They vary in terms of the different projects and things. So we came up with dash ones and dash two amendments. Now, if I may quickly say, and of course the good and high learned staff you have here has explained those to you basically, the first amendment, I believe, basically said every school district has to have some kind of policy on how they're going to handle the reserves. And they lay that out. And if any particular reserve is more than 10%, then they have to explain the 10%, and in effect, they have to do it even into line item items, if you will. It's very specific and very laid out. But the dash two amendments would strike the line item explanation. Is some people felt that the dash two amendments don't make them go on the line item in that explanation of why if the you're over 10% of what you said, but explain it, but don't force them to go into every single line item. So that's what the dash twos does. It's not as restrictive as the dash ones. And I'm being simplistic, but I hope I'm explaining it, and your great counsel here can tell you if I haven't. So that's basically what we're putting before all of you at this time, the dash one and the dash two items. Now, for the record, I want to point out something to you. I think as the dash one and amendments are drafted, maybe even the dash two, and I don't have those in front of me, if you go to line 6 on, what amounts to page 1.
We don't have dash 1s, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Well, the only thing, the only difference in between dash 1 and dash 2 is the paragraph relative to line items. That was deleted.
Well, if you go to line 6 on dash 2s, do you have dash 2s?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. All I'm going to say, it also appears on line 6. You'll see the words ending balance. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what it is. It's not 10% above your ending balance. It's 10% above your general fund. You understand what we're trying to say here? We don't think ending balance is the correct description. It should be the general fund. You understand this thing. Obviously, reading and raising the means, you understand the distinctions better than I do, but I don't think the ending balance, 10% above the ending balance, is what we intend at all. So it says, it specifies the percentage or percentage range of a district's general fund ending balance that the school district may carry over at the end of fiscal year to the next school year. We're not sure that ending balance is a correct statement there.
Mr. Chair and Mr. President, I think if we omitted the words ending balance, that would take care of it. That's the percentage of the general fund that we're talking about, that the district may carry over at the end of the fiscal year to the next fiscal year.
So, Mr. Chair, there's no dash three. You'd want a conceptual amendment to move this bill today. Just take out those two words.
Balance. The question I would have is if you are talking about a reserve and you're talking about a policy on reserves, the reserves could, in our circumstance here in the building, when we talk about a reserves, we talk about sometimes occasionally what we would reserve to the e-board. And then we talk about what the ending fund balance is, which is what we cannot actually appropriate from unless we come back into special session. Mm-hmm. School boards are different from the legislature. They can actually come back in and appropriate from their ending fund balance as long as they meet all the other budget requirements. So I actually think ending fund balance is closer to what you're trying to get to, because you're asking them, that would be their reserves in a sense. You're asking them that they establish what the reserves policy is. Remember that the articles in newspapers were relative to the ending balances, and the ending balances being disproportionate to what people felt in some cases were reasonable. So I think the ending fund balances, that is the correct language to be using at this particular juncture. I would also advise anybody that had a Senate bill that had never been to the House that if this becomes an issue, which I don't believe it will be, because I think ending fund balance is the appropriate term, that we make that correction in the House and not here, because I think legislative counsel and the legislative fiscal office will be a little bit worried if I start making conceptual amendments to policy bills in committee.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the reason why the sentence is awkward is because with the term ending fund or ending balance in there, it doesn't describe what the percentage is of. If you leave it out, then the sentence actually describes the ending fund balance. Because the sentence says that the school district will specify the percentage or percentage range of the school district's general fund that the school district may carry over at the end of the fiscal year to the next fiscal year. That describes the ending fund balance as in percentage terms. With the term ending fund or ending balance in there, then the term percentage is sort of modifying something that isn't in the sentence. And that's the problem with it. It isn't, of course, that we're not trying to deal with the ending balance. That is precisely what we're trying to deal with.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have problems voting on this bill with that language if we're not describing what we're trying to do here, because it's hard to explain it to people on the floor. It's what you're voting for, but not really, because we've got to change how it's worded. We're meeting tomorrow. Unless there's some need for you to get this out today, I would recommend we get the language right and do it tomorrow. But I'm amenable to getting it out today if you'd rather.
Okay. I think what we'll do with this, if the proponents concur, is rather than do a conceptual amendment here, which I do think legislative counsel will be down here in about 5 minutes if I try to do a conceptual amendment here.
Make that two.
Two. Yes. I will go on with the public hearing today. We will renotice this for a work session tomorrow. We will have a dash three prepared that will do what has been indicated. Look at it.
It was Could we actually?
Can legislative counsel confer with the chair?
Yeah.
I'm very informed.
By the way, Chair Devlin, everything I said about the ending balance could be wrong, you know.
I don't think so.
You're better than me.
You're the same.
He's smarter than me, not you. He's smart. He's smarter than him. Frighteningly so for me.
Senator Courtney and Representative Barnhart, we will have a dash 3 prepared for tomorrow, and we'll put it back on the agenda for tomorrow for a work session, and we will complete the rest of this public hearing today. We actually have one other party that wishes to testify.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Mr. Chair, how are we going to adjust that? Does the Senator and the Representative know how we're going to adjust that?
I would ask them to meet with Ms. Hunt, and she will explain.
They need some help.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do we have someone who can tell us, maybe it's Ms. McGlashan, how many districts currently have no policy at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gourley, I don't know. I don't know if there's someone in the audience that could address that. If they can, please raise your hand.
I think...
I don't know.
Senator Gourley, we did a lot of research on ending fund balance when the stories came out. And I think you will find some school districts that have some policies in place, others that do not. What we found largely was what Representative Barnhart had indicated. School districts were told, one, no one knew what the future of school funding was. Two, we did not know what the PERS rate would be. Three, we did not know what would happen with Measure 30 in terms of it being on the ballot. So school districts were basically cautioned to hold as much funding as they could in potential reserves to be able to get through a second year should Measure 30 fail, and to also have money in place for potential PERS rates that would occur in the next biennium. Once you look at all the school districts, you might find a few examples that are outside what you would think is a norm, even in those cases. And I think what the purpose of this measure now is to gain some greater transparency. But I don't think anybody actually did an inventory of how many different school districts have policies in place and to what degree there would be actually a wide range of what framework those policies took, in a sense.
It just seems to me that piece of information deserves to have an answer. You know, again, I have no problem with the policy statement that's being made here, but I'd like to know what the universe looks like, aside from newspaper articles and someone's research on the side that didn't necessarily look at the entire universe.
Is there anyone here who would want to basically comment on that? Anybody from OSBA or COSA? And then I do actually have one party that wants to testify on the bill in addition also.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Before I respond, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Gourley's question, I'd like to talk a little bit about circumstances over the past couple years which have led to, I believe, some extraordinary cash carryovers, ending balances, and so forth. Of course, I think first and foremost is the fact that the story that appeared looked at ending balances at the end, I believe, of the 2003-04 fiscal year. And that was the year, or 2003 was the year, as you know, of the longest session in Oregon history, when the legislature had not made a final decision on school funding until well after the July 1 deadline for adoption of school district budgets. And so there was a range of guesses that was going on in school districts relative to what the legislature's final appropriation might be. School boards, I believe, acted conservatively. I mean, they didn't want to overestimate the amount that they were going to receive, so they underestimated. As a result, the legislature came up with a higher amount
school districts put budgets together that they anticipated spending a lower amount, and therefore that left a cash carryover at the end. Second, during the '02 special sessions, the legislature enacted what's been termed the accrual. That is, the ability of school districts to, in effect, borrow their own money from a preceding fiscal year. Now, I'm not an accounting expert, but it's my understanding that if you, in fact, took advantage of that accrual and borrowed revenue from the next year to fund your programs and services for the current year, that that amount of money showed up on your books at the end of the fiscal year as cash. Now, even though you may have spent it during that fiscal year, it nevertheless showed up that way. Now, that's an accounting anomaly that I don't understand, but I think that was one of the issues. And finally, there's the issue of the way school districts are required to submit estimates to the Department of Education. This spring, for example, school districts submitted estimates so that the department could make a distribution of the state school fund for the fiscal year that starts on July 1. School districts look at the number of students, the types of students they have, in order to make the state school fund distribution formula work. Many times, school districts either overestimate or underestimate. Well, in the May payment, there's an adjustment made for the either underestimate or overestimate for the current fiscal year. So a school district in that May payment could find themselves, if they've overestimated, then they're going to receive less money in May. If they've underestimated, they're going to receive more money in May for the current year. In addition, that May payment also reflects the actual data from the prior year's audit. So school districts receive a payment in May that may be more than what they had anticipated because of those estimates. It's too late to spend it. So what you in effect have is an ending fund balance. There are also school districts that will, by policy and by practice and adopting their budget, adopt a contingency fund. That is, for the boiler in the high school blows up, they've got cash on hand to take care of those things and other unexpected expenditures that may be needed during the course of the fiscal year. They also may, in the course of adoption of their budget, adopt an unappropriated ending fund balance, and that is that they plan on a carryover. And that is generally to account for, we don't receive our property taxes till November. School starts in September. Right? From September to November is what we call that dry period, and although property taxes aren't a significant amount of our overall budgets as in the prior to Measure 5, there's still that period where school districts may want to carry cash over in order to spend up until they receive their property tax payments in November. So those are all circumstances, I believe, that are part of the natural budgeting process that can lead to at the end of a budget period showing up that it appears that there's cash on hand, and of course assertions are made about squirreling and rat holing and so forth that we don't believe are necessarily fair or accurate. It would seem to me that if we can get to a point where the legislature makes an appropriation to K-12 schools, and those are dollars that we can count on. And obviously, if you look at what's happened over the last two legislative sessions, the check the legislature wrote to K-12 bounced in the last two biennia. Now, that's not anything against the legislature. We didn't know the economy was going to tank after the 01 session. Some of us had hoped that Measure 30 would have passed after the 03 session. But in both cases, it's a circumstance where school districts just could not count on the appropriation that the legislature made of actually materializing. So what school districts have done is, because they couldn't count on the kind of stability they need to plan for year to year, count on the legislature providing that, have decided to take measures on their own to maintain some level of funding stability from year to year. The amendments before you, I think, obviously require more reporting, and it would seem to me, frankly, that any time in the course of local school districts putting together their budgets, and it's really no different than the considerations that you folks look at when you adopt a budget here. There's all kind of community push and pull about this program deserves funding. If you have to, then take it from this. And the program from which you want to take the money to fund something else has its own set of constituencies. So there's that push and pull in a local community about you better spend the money and not set it aside. And I think that ought to be a part of the natural policy making and political decision making role that occurs by individual school districts. I don't think any school board out there is intentionally, for lack of a better term, rat holing money at the expense of students in the classroom. What they're trying to do is create some level of stability from year to year so they don't spend up to a level and then have that money not materialize the second year and have to make even greater cuts. So that's sort of everything I know, and probably then some, about ending fund balances and the way that that local school districts and local school boards are forced to budget.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you very much for stepping forward to answer the question. I know you weren't scheduled to testify. I just think it's very important that we lay down as complete a record as possible of why the policy is needed. You know, what's the problem or issue that's being addressed that we're trying to correct? When we get to this point in the session, there's a tendency to hurry up and do whatever we're going to do. But again, we need to slow ourselves down and answer questions. So you don't necessarily know how many districts have no policy, but you have provided an explanation for what. Or how districts are looking at their challenges.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, it's my understanding that school districts may have a policy, and it may change from year to year, but when they begin the budgeting process, they decide on a policy that will guide the budget decision-making that says we want to create a contingency fund. So that's a part of you lay out the budget document, and here are all the expenditures, and then here's set aside as a contingency fund. There's a rule of thumb in the school business management world that suggests that anywhere from 3 to 5% is an appropriate level of cushion, if you will. That is the difference between your anticipated revenue and your anticipated expenditures, just to make up for that difference in the receipt of revenue versus what you plan to spend. And I think in normal times, that is, in times apart from what school districts have gone through the last 4 years, that's probably a rule of thumb that most school districts adopt. Now, whether that's in a board-adopted policy that guides the school district from year to year, sort of a cast in stone, this will be the number, I think it depends much like the legislature. When the legislature puts a budget together, there's always a discussion about what is an appropriate amount of ending balance that we want to plan for. And I think that's essentially the same way that occurs in individual school districts. They sort of take a look at the environment, and everybody's out there seeing that we're on sort of a, hopefully we've reached bottom and we're beginning to think that maybe we're crawling out of the economic hole we were in. And there are some that are going to say, wait a minute, you know, the bubble's going to burst again. The question is when, and we better therefore plan for it. The other issue, if I could, I think, is the concern about what PERS rates will do in, not in 2005-07, but in 2007-09. And there's a concern, I think, of pretty hefty increases in those PERS rates, and there's obviously an attempt on the part of a number of school districts to try to hold some dollars in reserve so that they'll be able to phase into those increased costs with as little pain and as little impact on the regular expenditures as possible.
Again, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I know you don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I mean, my sense is that right now the Department of Education requires about 61 reports. This would be 62. Well, Representative Barnhart say no, but the testimony we've seen in our thing is there's 61 different things that schools. I mean, I just don't see any reason for this bill. I mean, why are we doing this?
You might not get a disagreement from Mr. Marshall.
I'm sure I wouldn't, but I mean, why are we doing this?
Okay. One party has been very patient here, who actually did sign up to testify. Mr. Brown? Jeff Brown?
Not on this issue.
It says 10:53. Mistake. Okay. Okay. Mr. Barnhart, are you back here for a particular reason?
Yes, sir.
Can you be very quick?
Very quick. Again, I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11.
Take our time.
As we were talking with Legislative Council, we found another problem with the Dash 2s, and I wanted to alert you in case you had problems with our solution. The sub 3, lines 14 through 18, essentially says that if the amount of the ending fund balance in actual terms varies by 10% of the general fund, then you have to file a report. What the intention was, it would be 10% of the specified percentage range, which is a completely different thing, much narrower range. And our intention in the Dash 3s is to include that change in addition to the one we talked about in the sub 1. Okay. If that meets with the committee's sense
with
of the bill.
Chair sense, and the chair will consult the chief proponent of the bill, one of the chief proponents, and we'll get amendments prepared for tomorrow.
Right. The president's aware of it, and he agrees with it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment. I mean,
yes.
This makes a case. We're confused here. We don't know what this language means. What are we doing?
Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on 10:53. And I will open a work session on 10:71.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Senate Committee on Rules, and a staff measure summary from that committee staff has been distributed to you. This bill is sponsored by your subcommittee chair, Senator Devlin. And it creates the Oregon Virtual School District within the Department of Education to provide online courses to K-12 public school students. It allows the superintendent of public instruction to contract with public and private entities, including ESD school districts, community colleges, higher ed institutions, and public charter schools to provide online courses, which have to meet academic content standards as defined in statute and other criteria adopted by the State Board of Education. Directs the board to adopt rules for the procedures and criteria for selecting the online courses to be offered, as well as the qualifications of students who may access the courses. Requires a public charter school that offers online courses to have 50% or more of the students reside in the school district wherein the charter school is located. It would establish the Oregon Virtual School District Fund and transfer $2 million to the fund from the state school fund for the biennium beginning July 1, 2005. It also provides requires some progress reports by the Department of Education. You can see that requirement in Section 2 of the bill. No revenue impact statement has been issued yet, but this is essentially a redistribution of state school fund resources, regardless of whatever appropriation level the legislature approves. As far as the fiscal impact, the department expects some staffing would be needed to accomplish certain functions. The fiscal effect on school districts that currently offer online courses can't be determined right now because the standards and criteria haven't yet to be established by the board, and so the extent to which existing courses in the school districts would conform to the standards and criteria is unknown. There are Dash 1 amendments which have been distributed to you. These add that the instructor of an online course is to be properly licensed or registered as required by statute if employed by a school district or public charter school, and also eliminate the ability of ODE to contract with private entities, and also the amendments require the board to adopt rules to establish the number of credits for which students may access online courses, and require student-to-teacher ratio for online courses.
This bill, like the remaining bills that are on our agenda, had public hearings in their respective substantive committees, and here they will go into work session. I would state for the record that in the public hearing of 10:71, had. It was supported by the Department of Education, I believe both the Oregon School Boards Association, COSA, and the Oregon Education Association. So it's one of the few bills that you have here today that has universal support amongst the education community. Is there a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments?
So moved.
Okay. Senator Gordley has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, am I correct that this does create another school district, so we will now have 199 school districts?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Yes.
It would appear to me that the Dash 1 amendments significantly detract from the bill. I don't see any reason why private schools should be eliminated from it. I don't see any reason why, on your page 1, any person who teaches online course must be properly licensed and registered. I mean, that would eliminate somebody like an MBA or a world-class whatever from teaching those courses. I think it significantly detracts from your bill.
To state for the record, this would not actually preclude in an online camp class a party from featuring an individual like that, like someone who was a world-class expert in some area or a particular specialist in some area. It would simply mean that the class itself for credit would actually have to have a qualified instructor, a qualified teacher actually as part of the class. That's basically what it comes down to.
Is that a term called better bidding?
No, I think it's a term called basically, you'll also find in that it says that this party could be either a teacher at a public entity or they could be a teacher at a public charter school, which in which case 50% of charter school teachers have to meet no requirement greater than simply passing a background check. So, I mean, that would be an avenue for anyone to basically be able to teach in the course, to teach a course under this. It would be the normal standard that we utilize now in most of these programs that are in place in different school districts. Any additional comment?
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Looking at the Dash 1 amendments, what is the intent behind eliminating the phrase "or private" on line 27? What is it? What private entity did you have in mind?
I think the concern was expressed that it could be virtually any private entity. And maybe Ms. Fleming would be the one to comment on this, and since she's the one that participated in the drafting of the bench.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and Senator Gordley. I believe that the objection to the term private, and it was not the department's objection, was about learning management organizations coming in and managing schools outside of the purview of a local school district. I believe there is the possibility of mitigating any problem that there would be in contracting with a private provider in terms of developing administrative rules collaboratively with the field. There may be an instance where we would want, in fact, to contract with a company like Microsoft because they have built those virtual environments in other states, and we would want to be able to contract with their expertise.
And this language would permit that as the remaining.
I believe so, yes.
Well, is that a legislative council understanding of the language being permissive, or are we just saying it is because we want it? I need something more than what I'm hearing here about the meaning of private.
Chair Devlin, Lori Wimmer-Whalen is in the audience, and she's the one who brought the concern forward.
I'm asking about legislative council's understanding of the phrasing. Private.
We can get legislative council.
Yeah, not OEA. I mean, their perspective is fine. But
yeah.
Chair, I join in that. I don't see where we take it out of statute and put it back with administrative rule. That seems counterintuitive.
And let me also say, Mr. Chair, I'm going to support this. I just want to know what it is, what is behind the meaning of...
We'll get legislative counsel here, and Ms. Wimmer, why don't you come up and fill in the time until they get here.
Thank you, Senator Devlin, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Wayland, Oregon Education Association, always happy to oblige to fill in until legislative council gets here. Our concerns with respect to the language was a matter of clarity. We wanted to make sure that as it is true under brick and mortar school offerings, that we are sending public dollars to public institutions with respect to public school teachers offering programs. As the Department of Ed just testified, that does not preclude from our perspective the expertise of others being a part of an education program. We just want to make sure that we don't have public school dollars going to private religious institutions, for example, and to private education management providers, such as Edison Project and so on. That's our position with respect to brick and mortar schools as well, and that's Oregon law.
Yes, and it looks
like private education management.
Mr. Devlin, I don't know how to phrase this delicately, but it would seem.
Senator Witz, could you move the microphone a little bit?
Certainly.
Please? Thank you.
It would seem that that this would be an effort to. To me, it would seem to be an effort to preclude private enterprise from being competitive in educating our children. As mentioned before, Microsoft has quite a program. I mean, IBM wants to get into this program. Their IT programs that brought forward by IBM are some pretty amazing programs, and to exclude them statutorily doesn't make sense to me.
Well, we can wait for legislative counsel.
She's not waiting.
They should be here shortly. I would say that my understanding of this language is that you can contract with an entity that had any of these categories. It could be another school, it could be a school district, it could be an ESD, it could be a charter school, it could be a public university, a community college. And you could actually, in terms of wanting to provide like software, wanting to provide guidance, wanting to provide consultants, you could probably contract with any private entity. This simply would make it no different now than how state school fund dollars are distributed, is my understanding. And your example of brick and mortar is it's the same way state school dollars are distributed now.
Mr. Chair, that was what we were going for, and that's what our intent was.
So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The age that we're living in, this virtual world, is going to change the way we deliver services. I think we need to be a little flexible. I mean, I would have great trust. I know Vicki Fleming he doesn't have any trust for the Department of Education. If they're kind of contracting these people, they're not going to do something that's going to be detrimental. And even though that may be the state law, I mean, the thing is, we're not talking in bricks and mortars anymore. We're talking in virtual world. And
well, I think actually this points out one of the reasons why a companion bill to this actually will be coming to this committee is there are a whole lot of issues to work out amongst numerous providers in terms of distance learning to try to make it actually as beneficial to Oregon students as possible. Ms. Hunt. Senator Gordley, can you phrase your question?
Yeah, looking at the -1 amendment, this is Senate Bill 1071. Thanks for coming back. You may want to stay.
You may need to stay.
Yes, I'm 765. We may need you.
Line 5, which deletes the phrase or private from line 27. And my question is, my original question is, what is the intent behind eliminating the phrase or private? And I'm really trying to get at what is it that we are excluding when we use that phrase? How broad is the exclusion with regard to private enterprise.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley. I think the kinds of entities that you're excluding would be, for example, private higher education institutions, private businesses, perhaps, private, basically anything that's not a state or a public entity or a local entity, anything like that.
To clarify that, if I can, Senator Gordley, it would be, you would be precluding them from providing online courses. A provider of online courses could contract with them for portions of the services being provided.
Right. Chair Devlin, that's correct. You're precluding the superintendent of public instruction specifically from contracting with them directly. You're not precluding, for example, a community college or a state institution of higher education from entering into contracts with these entities.
And to do the comparison to the bricks and mortar example, my granddaughter attended the Delphi School for one summer, which actually is a very great, good school, very good private school, and helped her with some of her reading issues. The state school fund would now not pay for that.
Chair Devlin, yeah, I don't think that's an online course, so
right,
no.
Right,
no.
But I mean, if you're making the comparison between, there are private institutions that we do not use the state school fund to pay for, and this would not open the door to using state school funds to pay for that private instruction.
I'm sure, Devlin, if I understand the question correctly, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. We have a motion on the floor to pass the Dash 1 amendment. Will the committee staff call the roll?
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitson?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a motion to send SB 1071 to the full Senate Special Committee as amended with the due pass recommendation?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Whitson.
There's several questions. I want to support this bill. I think it's a good idea. I think we just made it a lot poor bill. That's it. I already said that. First of all, why is this an emergency?
Senator Whitson, I think one of the things is to get this upstarted and running. If it was an emergency, it would be effective either a specific date that we would give it, or generally we pass legislation that would say that something that doesn't have a specific date would not be effective until January 1st of next year. Although I can tell you quite honestly, I know that there has been a discussion going on the Senate floor about how many bills now have emergency clauses, and I think that isn't it.
Off the subject, half of them today.
Yes.
Second question, is this going to be available for homeschoolers?
Yes, it will.
Third question, why the 50% restriction on charter schools?
Ms. Fleming.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsett, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent of the Department of Education. The concern here is that we have charter schools in a virtual environment springing up and recruiting students statewide, and that creates an adverse impact in the state school fund currently. And so the idea here was to say, if you want to provide education in a virtual environment, that's great, but you probably ought to restrict your enrollment to only half the kids being recruited from outside of the district, so that if you're specifically targeting students who are homebound or homeschool students, that would accommodate most likely the number of children in your district that you would want to be able to recruit to connect back to the public system. We had an instance in Coquille where a projected enrollment went from around 200 students one year to 1,200 the next, which when you calculate out the ADM in a virtual environment, that's a big impact on the state school fund. In addition, the charter described a teacher-student ratio that was really not viable, 1 to 150 students. And in fact, the instruction was slated to be provided by parents rather than licensed teachers. So for all of those reasons, we denied the district's request for that school fund projection and then began to deliberate on a variety of issues that would manifest themselves in a bill.
Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think another way of looking at the emergency clause is to appreciate that Oregon is way behind other states in providing distance learning opportunities. I can't remember exactly where we fall. Ms. Fleming may know that among the 50 states.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, we're right about in the middle of the pack, but I would say in terms of our ability to do a statewide venture in this regard, we are definitely behind the curve.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, I think I am for now. No, actually, I'm not. I'm thinking about the Frontier Learning Network, and we need, as we go forward, we need to describe and define where and how our experience with the Frontier Learning Network connects with this new effort that's going to involve and serve more Oregon students, so that, you know, we're all understanding that the Frontier Learning Network isn't just dropping off a cliff somewhere, but there's a connection here that's going to move all of this forward. Is that accurate to
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley? Absolutely. The reason for creating a virtual school district, and as we talked about in the policy committee, I think this is probably the first one of its kind in the nation, would be to have a district umbrella, an infrastructure, if you will, that would connect all the existing opportunities to one another so that students anywhere in Oregon could have access to the resources and content developed by the Frontier Learning Network, as well as the Cool School and Salem Kaiser Online, and that, in fact, those would become online schools within this virtual school district infrastructure. And everybody would have access to everything, ideally.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hart. Yeah, I think this is a really great idea. I'm going to support this bill. Just a couple things. One, I would hate the committee to have the impression that we're behind in this thing. I mean, actually, the state of Oregon has a state-of-the-art technology system. This probably is going to be fairly easily implemented. Mm-hmm. I think Senator Gorley's comments about the Frontier Fund, and I know there's Frontier Network and some of the other ones that are here, and there are already models out there that years. I guess my concern is that this thing doesn't become too centrally top-heavy. I mean, from your viewpoint, I mean, you guys got a lot on your plate at the Department of Education. I'm just always, you know, I know you do lots of good things, but, you know, at some point, we can't provide you the funding for a lot of these things, and you can't do the job. And so the devil's going to be in the details. How do you get to the point where, you know, you can make this an effective thing? And there are already models out there to do, and we've got a great infrastructure already in place. So, I mean, I think there's some real positives here. I appreciate the chair bringing the floor.
Senator Nelson, didn't you want to take $20 million out of the department?
For other reasons. I don't want to have 62 reports.
Just wondering.
With that, any additional discussion on the main motion? Hearing none, will we call the roll? And if Senator Whitsitt doesn't return, show him as being excused.
Senator
Gordon?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Motion passes. I will carry the bill to the full and carry it to the floor. I'll open a work session on SB 765. Oh, did I close it? Okay. I will close the work session on 1071. I will open a work session on SB 765A. Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 765A came from the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce. Staff member summary from that committee staff on the A and Gross version of the bill has been distributed to you, as has a revenue impact statement. Under this bill, the State Board of Education is to designate qualified education service districts as regional education service agencies, also known as REESAs,
And the bill specifies the duties and the missions of these RESAs. The criteria are established for an ESD to become one of these entities, a RESA. The superintendent of public instruction is to present school districts with three or more models for organizational structure for ESDs, one model to be based on the current structure, one a designation of ESDs as the regional education service agencies, and then one based on a variation of the first two models. Then school districts are to prioritize their choices of the models. The superintendent is to make a recommendation to the board based on school district responses, and section 4 of the bill on page 3 describes in more detail what those recommendations are to contain. And then the board is directed to adopt a plan for reorganization based on the superintendent's recommendation and to enter an order on or before March 31st of 2006 to merge or divide ESDs based upon the adopted plan, and that order is effective July 1st, 2007. The bill also talks about the development of local service plans for approval by ESD's component school districts and the minimum amount of services to be included in those plans. The bill specifies conditions for entrepreneurial services, and the bill also modifies provisions regarding district boards and budget committees. There's no revenue impact in 06-07 on total ESD funding or the allocation of the funding, but in 07-09 there will likely be a minor shift in the per student allocation of ESD revenue and distribution of state school fund dollars to the reconfigured ESDs. The fiscal impact at this time is uncertain, but there is likely to be something of a fiscal impact, perhaps related to the staff time to develop the models. It just depends on how far along in this process the Department of Education already is.
With that, I will, since there are no amendments to this bill, I'll accept a motion, and then we will go to discussion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 765A to the full committee on special Senate Committee on Budget.
With the due pass.
With a due pass recommendation. I think I got that out correctly.
We have a motion on the table. Discussions? Senator
yes.
Walker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do is I had Ms. Hunt stay, and so I'd like to have her come to the table, and also Marjorie Taylor, who is my committee administrator for my committee, just in case there are questions, and then they can be at the ready. And, Mr. Chair, this is a long bill. It has 32 sections, and would you like a brief section-by-section analysis? How would you like me to present
this? Just very brief, maybe not section by section, because the intent is actually to move this bill to the full committee. And any additional beyond what Ms. McGlashan has presented would probably be beneficial, but anything that you think that she did not cover.
Okay. Well, I think there are a couple of issues, because even I needed to be have my memory refreshed. This morning I asked Ms. Taylor to join me on the floor because we sent this out of our budget committee back in, or our policy committee back in April. So this is an overhaul, basically, of the education service district system. I was given that task as part of my responsibilities as chair of the Education and Workforce Committee. I had great assistance from a number of people, but I do want to give credit to Senator Jeff Cruz, who I put in charge of the work group. He did a great job, and Ms. Taylor staffed that committee, and Ms. Hunt was there as we wrote the bill. The department played a role as well, and we had a number of education service district, school district personnel and folks on the work group. The issue of education, regional education service districts or associations, or RESAs as they're called, one of the elements I want to be clear about that is that not all ESDs will become a RESA. Some will and some won't. The RESA will be more of the administrative function, and the ESDs will continue to provide the services. So I do want to be clear about that element. And we set March 31, 2006 as the deadline for addressing, making the choices, making the proposals, and making the choices because we want to get that system moving forward. and finally implemented on July 1 of 2007. And that gives us some time in the legislative session if there are some further changes to the statutes that we need to make or any final adjustments. Will ESDs be consolidated under this bill? Mr. Chair, I can't say that for certain. I can say likely. Always ESD consolidation creates jitters among a lot of folks, particularly the frontier districts out in Senator Nelson's neck of the woods and Senator Whitsitt. And in fact, I will tell you that the Lake County ESD person on the work group, Judy May, did not agree with this bill. But I think I'm not sure I'd ever get agreement from the frontier districts on what we're trying to do. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, I think we allow some greater flexibility. We allow greater accountability. One of the things we heard in our policy committee was that school districts didn't have much say over how ESDs spent their money. And so school districts have much more say here. The core services of the ESDs are more clearly defined in this bill. There's more communication and delivery of services, and also we're asking in Section 9, we're asking the ESDs to help do a little more data collection than they are right now, which I think is appropriate. We have a budget committee that will serve that's appointed, that has some appointed members on it. That will help create the local service plan. That piece doesn't create the jitters so much, Mr. Chair, as the governance structure. And the governance structure is kind of what makes people nervous, because eventually we will get rid of all elected ESD positions and they will become appointed, but they will become appointed by their local school boards who are elected folks. So that's the one piece of the bill that gives some people some concern, but actually that was the piece I liked the best, and some of the school districts particularly like that. The other point I wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, is that we are going to require an annual financial report to the Budget Committee. You'll find that in Section 12. That is really important. That provides checks and balances to how the ESDs are spending their money, so we don't have the issues that we had in the Union Baker ESD, which, if you haven't heard about it by now, they bought an airplane and did other things that were inappropriate. So let's see. The budget structure, I went over that. We delete the geographic boundaries in the bill because those will be rewritten as we choose the new model. And I think, let's see, what else do we have? We deal with vacancies on the board. We stagger terms of office as we implement the new ESD model, and we also preserve labor union agreements, Mr. Chair. That was important because if you're going to consolidate ESDs, you've got employees that need to go somewhere, and if they're consolidated into the new ESD, those labor agreements need to be preserved. So that was really important for all of us who were dealing with this. I think that, in a nutshell, is a pretty good overview without doing a section-by-section analysis, and just adds to what Ms. McGlashan gave us.
Okay. Are there any questions? Senator Whitsitt?
Yes. This bill apparently consolidates bond indebtedness among the various districts. I don't know about the legality of assigning a debt to a district that didn't vote to incur that debt.
I think this would be best for Ms. Hunt to answer. Mm-hmm. I have seen this circumstance, and typically those parties that were not originally obligated are not obligated in the future.
Yeah, Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt. The bill would only consolidate or shift, I guess, the debt responsibility in the case of ESDs which merge. If they aren't merging, then, of course, the debt is not going to be consolidated. You know. And I think under the bill what it does is it talks about having a plan for debt consolidation and so forth. So it wouldn't necessarily be applied to folks who didn't originally incur the debt. It would depend on the plan.
Yes. Mr. Devlin, I'd have to disagree with that. If you have two service districts represented, one of them has incurred a debt and the other hasn't, and you merge the two, and now suddenly that entire district has assumes the debt of District A, then the people in District that were originally in District B did not incur that debt. They just got assigned that debt. Am I wrong there?
I think we can get a clarification of that actually before the bill comes up to the full. My only circumstance with this in the past, and the circumstance is very rare, is I have had a few changes in school district boundaries. Not actually in school attendance boundaries for individual schools, but school district boundary changes where one school district had one level of general obligation debt and one had a different level. And I can remember there was some adjustment done there, but I think it would be best to get legislative counsel. We can get that answer by full on what would happen in this particular case.
Your second question, Mr. Chair, is along the same lines, that is liabilities that have been incurred by one district or are now going to be shared also. I wonder if that's been addressed.
I'd ask legislative counsel a comment. I would guess in that case, yes.
Yeah. Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, if you look on page 3 of the bill, section 5, subsection 3, it talks about a situation where two ESDs are merging to form a new one. And the question that you just asked, I think, is answered on lines 43 to 45, where it talks about the order shall also include provisions for the distribution of any assets or liabilities of the ESDs that are being merged or divided under this section. So it would go back to the order and what the order says as far as how those assets and liabilities will be distributed. However, potentially, assets and liabilities could be distributed over the entire new education service district.
That's the way I read it, that it would be, as with the bonded indebtedness.
Yeah.
I don't know any other way you could do it, but, I mean, my question is it legal under a current law to impose a liability on folks that didn't vote for that liability, both current liability and bonded future the mortgage, so to speak?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, this section follows the form of when we did school district mergers, also where they did, I think, spread some of the bonded indebtedness over the entire school district. And I don't believe any of that was challenged. So in answer to your question, yes, it's legal.
But Chair, there were a couple of other things I wanted to point out because Senator Ringo was pretty adamant about this, and so were members of the group work group. We really tried to narrow what school districts could do with their entrepreneurial activities, or what ESDs, not school districts, excuse me, could do with their entrepreneurial activities. So in Section 12 of the bill, you'll see that one of the elements for engaging in these kinds of activities is that the primary purpose must address a need of the component school district. So they can't be doing something just to make money for the ESD that doesn't have its primary purpose as serving kids. That was critical and important enough to us that I noticed the House introduced a bill and sent it over our direction that just only addresses the entrepreneurial activities. So I know that our colleagues in the House had the same concerns. This bill also will give, I could have whacked away, Mr. Chair. I could have just said, heck, we're going to have 12 ESDs and you like it, you take it. If I get it through, we've got it. I don't like that approach because some of these rural ESDs really like where they are. They like who they're connected with. They don't want to be whacked off and left with nothing. So this bill gives a great deal of flexibility and latitude for districts to decide, hey, you know what? I don't really like the ESD I'm in under this
this scenario, this bill, I'm going to suggest that we be put in another ESD. So it gives a lot of flexibility to the ESDs to decide how they want to be structured and who they want to be partnering up with and whether they want to be a RESA. I thought it was a pretty good piece of work. I was actually very impressed, and we've come at ESDs year after year after year, and it never gets out of the building because everybody wants to protect their own turf. I think this does that, but also gives a great deal of vision to work with. So that's why I think the bill's a good bill.
Any additional comment?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Two questions. Thank you. First of all, appreciating the leadership that Senator Walker has provided on this bill. A lot of hard work, long hours. I'm wondering, Section 10, page 5, lines 36 through 40, lay out a criteria for development of local service plans by an ESD and a district or districts. And I'm reading these as priorities, programs for children with special needs, including but not limited to special ed, services for at-risk students, professional development, etc. The definition of at-risk students in this case is what?
I will ask counsel if she can define that. Put her on the hot seat.
Okay.
Ms. Hunt?
Yeah. Or
Ms. Taylor might be able to.
Sorry, Chair Devlin, I was finding the place in the bill that Senator Gordley was referring to.
Line 39?
Yeah, on page 5.
Yes.
Okay. In the bill, it doesn't specifically define what an at-risk student is. So in answer to your question, it would be a combination of the Department of Education has given some rulemaking authority over the implementation of the bill. So that would be within their authority to define at-risk student. It would also be up to the local ESD to define at-risk student and address that in their local service plan. So it could potentially vary from ESD to ESD, depending on their local needs.
What's behind my question, again, I'm thinking about the growing population of ESL, ELL students, historically underserved. How do we make sure that the needs that these students present are in fact prioritized and dealt with effectively? That's a question and a concern. And then, Mr. Chair, in from lines 41 to 43, there's a description of technology support for component school districts, et cetera. And given the bill that we didn't pass, it's coming back to us, the virtual school district bill, I'm wondering where the connection will be with that effort as it goes forward and what it is we may be expecting ESDs to take on, and how do we ensure that efforts are in fact collaborative and not duplicated and et cetera.
Senator Gurley, I believe the bill that we did pass out to the full 1071 would lead to further collaboration. Some of the testimony that occurred on the bill in the Rules Committee is that there are currently, I believe, 3 ESDs with established distance learning programs, and actually that would probably enable them to expand some of those programs and encourage other ESDs to become involved in those programs. So,
and Mr. Chair, my guess would be that the RESA, the Regional Education Service Agency, would be the one that would kind of set up that policy and work with the Department of Ed as to how it might be administered through the ESDs. That sounds more like a RESA type of thing than a local ESD, at least in terms of the big picture and coordinating with this new school district that we are creating.
Could I get a nod at least from the Department of Education that says you're looking at this piece? And
Senator Gordley, for the sake of the record, nods cannot be noted. So, Ms. Fleming, will you come forward and identify yourself?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, Vicki Fleming, Department of Education. I was a part of Senator Walker's, Senator Cruz's work group, and in fact, what we envision is a regional delivery system where the agencies would be the hub for a variety of core services and would represent the capacity to provide those services in collaboration with the districts that would be still serving their constituent districts, but would not in fact be able to provide everything that the larger agency would provide. So in a virtual environment, there are in fact 7 ESDs that are involved in distance education at this point in time, and we would look to them in fact to be that decentralized regional operation that would work more effectively than what we currently have.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Well, I'm going to oppose this bill just because it's like there's several reasons. It looks like the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts on April 21st, 2005 voted to be opposed to this bill. I don't know if that's changed in a month and a half. But it seems like those are the experts that we have in this field. And, you know, for us as legislators, I think we can somehow solve problem that is unique to each and every community. This doesn't seem to fly with me. Talking about being entrepreneurial, I think the legislators require these ASDs to become entrepreneurial. We've cut off their funds, and you guys go out and project, and we were talking about, well, this allows them some flexibility for contract. They can contract now. That was one of the things that got the Union Baker thing in difficulty. They were contracting out in Lakeview and over here, and get there, and it was, you know, they're 300 and 400 miles, so it's easier to fly than to drive, and time, and they had some cost savings and risk benefits, and probably was not a good decision in hindsight, but I thought they were probably working in good faith. I know there's 2 SDs that don't even use any general funds. One of them's in my part of the country, in Malala County, so are we telling them how they should be providing their services? I think the other one's a Grant County. They take care of things at their level. Somebody's got to provide these services. And I haven't seen any cost savings. At least, I guess the cost savings I've heard is, well, we'll solve it by getting rid of all these rural guys. Well, there's really no money out there in the rural areas. And, I mean, there's huge distances out there. And for us to come in and say, well, this is how we're going to solve this problem, I think that's well way beyond our capacity. So I'm going to oppose this bill based upon those reasons. I think we're solving a problem that we really have no expertise in, and 2 weeks or 2 months of hearings isn't going to give us that expertise.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Whitson.
I too will oppose the bill. My reason is that I believe I've been contacted by every ESD in the district that I represent, with the Southern Oregon ESD, which encompasses over 10% of the students in K-12 education, all the way out to North Lake, which is, you know, if you blink, you miss it. And they're unanimous in their opposition to this bill as it's written. In their words, this bill will strip any semblance of representation from rural areas, will eliminate public influence on budgets, ESDs, and actually it will eliminate any elections to the budget committees. And it will direct bonded indebtedness to those who did not incur that bonded indebtedness. And one of the other reason that I would oppose it, and this didn't come from the ESDs, was similar to what Senator Nelson just articulated. I don't see where the cost savings here is. I don't see where we're going to cut down the number of employees. Actually, there's a part of the bill, as I read it, that addresses that, and it doesn't indicate that there's going to be any reduction in FTEs. They'll just be reassigned. When we talk that most of our K-12 budget is consumed by personnel, something like 80% of it across the board, and we're not going to cut the FTEs, where are we going to save the money?
Thank you, Senator Woodson. Committee, I will be supporting this bill. I have actually been looking at the work that has been done both in the Senate and the House on the ESD issue. I believe there are questions here that still need more answers, but I'm hoping that those discussions will occur in this process in the coming weeks. One of the items to keep in mind, though, is there have been multiple proposals in this building for how to modify ESDs. some of them as strong as I think Senator Walker said, just simply limiting them to 10 or 12. Others that had slightly different approaches. I can tell you in discussions with the superintendent of public instruction, I think clearly the fears in eastern and central Oregon, well, I think founded in some legitimate concern, I don't think that there will be as many potential mergers as some people may think in eastern Oregon, particularly in central Oregon, because I think everybody recognizes that you have to take into consideration not only the number of students, but the vast geography of the area. It should be kept in mind, too, that ESDs have been consolidated before, and rather substantially before. That one has already occurred recently. Yamhill County was consolidated here recently. Another ESD may or may not be consolidated here sometime in the near future. That decision will be up to the superintendent and the Board of Education. But with that, I will support this. One of the things I do think, the issue of governance, I know, is a very difficult issue. And to be honest, about two-thirds, I believe, and I don't think, Senator Walker, you covered about everything, but I don't know if you commented on this, but about two-thirds of the ESDs participated in discussions about these bills. At one time, they were generally in favor, but I think that the governance issue is something that particularly why they're almost now universally opposed. I think there are some things about this governance structure that are better, some things that might have some problems. One of the things that's better, I think, is the actual representation of individual school districts on the ESD boards. That could more clearly identify the needs. Now, what you will be told is that there are resolutions that have to be passed and that those resolutions are supposed to account for 90% of the funds to the ESDs, and those have to be approved by school districts representing at least 51% of the students. There is a difference between a resolution process and having a seat at the table. All of us have been in electoral processes, and I've known many ESD board members, and I think they do excellent government service. But I can tell you, in my individual school districts, school board members running for election receive a great deal of scrutiny, at least in my region, more than ESD board members. I could probably not find too many even school board members that could name their ESD board members. So with that, I will be supporting the measure. Any additional comments from the committee?
Just a couple of questions.
Yes.
Again, for the record, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, two-thirds of the existing ESDs participated in creating these proposals?
Not all of it. Not all. They were part of a discussion group originally.
Yeah, I thought
they weren't part of my work group that I asked Senator Cruz to chair. They were part of a group. Their own group came forward with a proposal at the beginning of the session. And Mr. Rose is probably in the room, and he could speak to that if you need him to. And I think he could also tell you that the whole reason that they oppose this as an organization now is this governance structure. Other than that, I think they like the bill. Is Mr.
Since reference has been made to Mr. Rose, would he like to comment? Is he in the room?
He was in the room.
We don't get him soon, we will go to a vote.
While we look for him, do you want to ask your second question?
Yeah.
The second question is tied to the
first.
The first. Again, I'm just trying to establish clarity for the record of where the proposal is coming from, meaning who developed it and who is opposed in terms of organizations, just so that we're establishing that for the record in this committee.
I would say, Mr. Chair and Senator Boardley, that the Oregon Association of ESDs did not participate as an association on the work group that I set up. They were outside the room like everyone else, not allowed in, but an ESD superintendent, actually there were several ESD superintendents, three. There was Judy May from Lake, there was John Hill from Douglas ESD, and there was also Rick Howell from South Coast ESD, and then we had some school district folks. So we had ESD representation on the work group, and as I indicated, Ms. May was the only one who opposed the final work group product. Is that correct, Ms. Taylor?
Marjorie Taylor, Committee Administrator, Senate Education, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, and Senator Gordley. Yes, on the work group we had Senator Cruz, Senator Ringo, Vicki Fleming, Jim Sager, John Hill, Judy May, Rick Hell, Craig Rossler from Silver Falls ESD. We also included the superintendent of Hillsboro in our communications. And at the end, Rick Hell was not available to participate in our final discussions, and you're correct, Judy May did not support the final recommendation.
Yes.
However, the original bill, the original 765, was proposed by the OAESD, and it was off of that bill that we had our work group, and we amended the bill.
Okay.
At this particular juncture, I'll say, Mr. Rose, we will go to a vote on the main motion. This is a motion to send to the full committee Senate Bill 765A to the Senate Special Committee on Budget with a two-pass recommendation. Will you please call the roll?
Aye.
Nelson?
No.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator
Whitson? No.
Aye. Motion passes, and Senator Gordley, will you carry to the full? And I will ask the chair of the Senate Special Committee to have Senator Walker carry it, the bill to the floor.
Oh, joy. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will close the work session on SB 765. We will open a work session on SB 639A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is your final bill for today. This bill came from the Senate Committee on Revenue. A staff measure summary from that committee staff on the engrossed version of the bill has been distributed to you. This bill establishes the Oregon Educators Benefits Board with 10 members appointed by the governor. It requires the board to provide a high-quality plan of health and other benefits for eligible employees at affordable cost to both the districts and the employees. It defines eligible employees. Directs the board to contract for health and dental benefit plans by October 1st, 2006. Allows the board to administer flexible benefit plans. Requires the board to offer a range of plans so that an employee can choose a comparable plan to what the district provided and at a similar cost. Allows the board to contract for life insurance, supplemental medical, dental and vision, and accidental death or disability plans. Requires the board to offer a long-term care insurance plan. The bill also creates the Oregon Educators Benefit Account for administrative expenses and deposits up to 2% of employer and employee premium contributions in the account, and requires school districts to participate in board plans by October 1st, 2006 with certain exceptions. And those are in Section 18 of the bill. Creates a task force on teacher health benefits after July 1st, 2009 to review the benefit plans to determine whether cost savings were achieved by the board, and requires a report to an interim committee by October 1st, 2010. There was similar legislation introduced in the 2003 session with the assumption that significant savings could be achieved by creating a statewide health insurance pool for school employees. There's no revenue impact. The fiscal impacts we're still working on. There will likely be some upfront costs and startup costs that will need to be funded. There's nothing earmarked in the governor's budget for this, or I believe in the House budget plan or the Senate budget plan for that matter. I think the intent was to have around $5 million either in the DAS budget or the Department of Education's budget for the startup cost, but the funds aren't in either budget at this point, so that's something to consider.
Thank you, Ms. Melashin. For the committee's consideration, I have been asked by the co-chair on the Senate side, and obviously the same person, the chair of the special committee, to move this bill today, and that the cost of it will be accommodated in our budget proposal. Is there a motion on the bill, and then we'll go to discussion?
Oh. So moved. I'm thinking in all frankness, I'm thinking about the $5 million and where that's going to come from. And given the choices, the two possibilities are DAS or the Department of Education.
I think the intent here is that for the ending fund balance. Since this is a proposal that's being put forward from the standpoint of potential long-term savings, I have been directed to move the bill today. With that, your motion included a included to send it to the Senate Special Budget Committee with a do-pass recommendation.
I'll accept that amendment. Yes.
Okay. With that, is there any additional discussion? Since this is in work session and not in a public hearing, we will not accept public testimony unless there is a question to any party that's within the room at this time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My angst level is high. I had the same question that Senator Gordley had, is where is this money going to come from, and is there actually any savings? I can't vote for a bill. I don't know. They say projected savings, potential savings. We're dealing with a very complicated industry, insurance. I just can't see that there's any. I just can't support this bill. So, you know, that'll be a no vote.
Chair Devlin, I have some questions. On page 4, section 5, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board may employ whatever means are reasonably necessary to carry out the purposes. That sounds like quite dictatorial powers for an appointed board. And as you read through the bill, it even gets worse. Basically, this board has the ability to bring in the district, to bring in all the employees. Once you're in, you can't get out. From day one now on this bill, it's all worded that you can get in, but you can't get back out once. The proponents of it talk about having competition within the system, but I'm not sure when you have it in a complete monopoly how you can possibly have competition.
The best person to answer some of these questions now might be Mr. Sager. Would you want to come forward? There is an opt-out provision, I believe, in the current bill.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, James Sager from the governor's office. Let me first address your question, Senator. Yes, there is an opt-out provision in the bill for those school districts that currently have trust programs in place or self-insurance programs in place. And the requirement is that if they can provide the same level of benefit at lesser cost than what is provided in the pool, then they can remain out. So if inside their setup they have been able to put together all those savings and programs that we believe should be available statewide, then they could remain outside of the pool. The other group that is allowed up front to decide whether they're going to join or not are the community colleges, and the reason for that is because currently our 17 community colleges, some are involved with city and county pools that are kind of existing outside the system, so we didn't want to have an adverse impact on those other programs.
Mr. Sager, I understand that, I believe, but my point was that once you have decided to become a part of this system, whether you be an employee or whether you be a district or whether you be a community college, once you have decided to become a part of this system, you can't go back. If you don't like it, if it's not working, you're stuck. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator.
Thank you.
opportunity. Additional question.
Yes.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. What was the fiscal statement that you made, Ms. McGlashan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, at this point, we haven't developed the formal fiscal statement, but last session when this bill was introduced, I believe there was about $5 million earmarked for startup costs for the program, and so the belief is that it would be about the same amount for but this bill as well.
But we don't have any assumptions around what the estimated savings might be from implementing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, that's correct, and I believe that's why the task force is established, to come back and report on the actual savings that have been achieved through this measure.
I might comment on that, Senator Gordley, that there were extensive hearings on this bill in the Revenue Committee on that very subject. Mm-hmm. You will get broad disagreement on the potential savings. I have heard figures all the way from opponents of the bill who don't believe that there is any potential savings, and in some cases may believe that there's greater cost. Proponents of the bill that have marked the savings on a biennial basis probably in the range of 75, maybe. Last session, the estimates were as high as $100 million in a biennium. Most recent ones I've heard are probably in the 60, 75, 80 range.
Who was opposed to this measure?
Oregon School Boards Association.
The Oregon School Boards Association is opposed to the measure.
Anyone else?
Local insurance agents.
Yes.
Another question, yes. Or just an observation. I'll be a courtesy vote on this, okay. On this one. Just appears to me that I'm trying to understand a study coming after a plan is implemented as opposed to the study coming first and then the implementation. Maybe I'm missing something.
Maybe Mr. Sager could comment. There have been references to several studies mm-hmm. in other states. That was part of the previous testimony.
But I mean a study in Oregon.
Right. There was some discussions of a study during this interim, but we could not get parties in agreement on the criteria for that study, and maybe Mr. Sager might want to comment.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, that is correct. The studies that have been done in other states have cost in the neighborhood of $500,000 or more. As all of you are well aware, we don't have that kind of money available for a study. We did have conversations to see if several participants would be willing to put money in, and could we agree as to the parameters and what the study would do and what the conclusions would lead to, et cetera, and we were not able to come to agreement on that. I would also, if I may, Chair Devlin, has clarified the $5 million number. As Sue McGlashan indicated, it was supposed to have been included in the governor's budget. There was confusion between the departments as to whether it would appear in the DAS budget or the Department of Ed budget, actually a number appearing there, and in the work that was done, it was left out of both. So there would be a technical adjustment to that. I'd also like to clarify that that would be the top end of the cost, and the 2% fee that comes back in then would, in essence, buy down that cost factor. So we were trying to figure out what we knew as it phases in would be the cost of the program to get it up to that point, not knowing exactly for sure what the total revenue would be during what would be the second year of this biennium coming in to buy that number down.
Follow up.
Yes.
The measure is supported by the governor, Mr. Sager?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, yes.
Okay. Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Sager, may I just sort of address this, but it seems there's two sources of funding here. On page 5, section 7, sub 2, the board may assess a charge as part of the premiums to pay the cost of administering the plans. And it goes on to say on page 7, sub 13, or section 13, sub 2, there hereby is appropriated this amount subject to section 14 of this act, an amount not to exceed 2% of the monthly employer and employee contributions. Is that a explanation of the same charge twice, or is that two different charges?
Chair Devlin, Senator Woods, if that's an explanation of the same charge, one is that they can levy it, the other is that an account would be set up for it. This structure is almost identical to the current structure that exists for the PEB program for the state employees, and so we followed that same kind of structure in order to have the correct accounts so that money could go in and flow through the system properly.
Thank you.
Primarily, is that general fund money we're talking about from either DAS or Department of Ed?
Chair Dillon, Senator Nelson, yes, it would be general fund money or less than that. Like I said, as the revenues came in from the 2% charge.
And that's the other question. This 2% charge, now where's that coming from? Who's paying it?
Senator Devlin, Senator Nelson, that is part of the premium structure that would be charged for these plans. The board is allowed to levy up to 2% as the PEB board currently is. It can be less than that, but it's the maximum of what they're allowed to charge, and that would cover then any and all administrative costs inside the program.
And one more question. Would that cover the cost of premiums? You're just talking about administrative costs.
That is to cover the administrative costs of that program, yes. The PEB system, I believe, is down to about 0.6% is what they actually end up charging. Yes.
What is, you have an actual figure on administrative costs?
Again, Senator, to go along looking at the PEB structure, and what we're simply doing is taking a program that has worked well as far as administrative costs is concerned and said we're going to simply expand that structure to meet the additional pool that is brought in to the system. And so, again, we're very hopeful. We believe that we would be able to have as tight administrative structure as, in fact, we currently enjoy, and thus we would end up with the 0.6% actual cost. Therefore, they don't levy the difference.
Okay, I will.
Senator Walker, then Senator Whitsitt.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things I want to point out. One is there have been several studies done. They just all haven't been done here in Oregon. There has been a Minnesota study. The Minnesota legislature and the Pennsylvania legislature spent over $500,000 to determine whether this was a good program. They reached similar conclusions that voluntary purchasing pools help save money on variable costs and mandatory purchasing pools save money on fixed costs. Also, based on the Minnesota study, a firm of Watson and Wyatt estimated that Oregon could save more than $182 million over 5 years on fixed costs once the pool is fully operational. And then in 2003, there were three separate studies done by three different global actuarial and consulting firms. Watson and Wyatt again said you could save $65 million annually. OSBA, through its actuary, Mercer Human Resources Consulting, estimated you could save $74 million annually. And the Oregon legislature asked the Oregon Department of Education and Aon Consulting to do a study, and they estimate a savings of $99 million in biennial savings, or approximately $50 million annually. You can argue these studies to death, and people will always do that if they're on the opposite side of the issue. But one thing you can argue, Mr. Chair, is that there isn't a study anywhere that indicates pooling won't save money or that it's a bad idea. People just try to pick apart the studies. Additionally, I would point out that in this bill on page 11 in section 22, there's created the task force on teacher health benefits. And that task force shall review the benefit plans provided through the Oregon Educators Benefit Board that will be created with this bill and analyze the benefits provided by and the administration of the benefit plans and determine whether this has resulted in cost savings to the state. And that task force shall submit a report no later than October 1, 2010. So we're not entering into this blindly. I think there's plenty of evidence on the record to indicate to us that we can save money, and we are going to track that cost savings and see where we're going with this. So I think this bill pulls it all together very nicely, and I think we should move forward on it.
Mr. Chair, a question for Senator Walker.
Mm-hmm.
The yes, if Senator Whitsitt is okay with what's going on.
Okay.
The Minnesota study, did that then result in implementation in Minnesota of a plan?
Mr. Sager could probably answer that question.
Chair Devlin, Senators, none of the states have implemented the plans yet. The most recent, Michigan is also on that list, by the way. Their legislature is dealing with this, and the Governor Taft's Blue Ribbon Task Force just came out with the same conclusion. So this is not an Oregon creation. This is quite a movement across the country.
Now, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sager, you know, monopolies are generally noted for poor service and high costs and lack of innovation, particularly in government monopolies. How do you envision a competitive insurance community if this plan is implemented?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, a couple things. First, we have to change the view of where the competition is supposed to exist. Is it between school districts to say, gosh, I got a better rate than you did, or is it within the education system, Oregon's education system, in being able to compete for the best rates and services for the employees and the employers in that system? That's the way the governor views this, that we need to look at this as in essence, a corporate entity, and we don't have 220 individual subsidiaries out there kind of doing their own thing, trying to get the best they can, depending upon the circumstances, and then sending the bill here. That when we look at the kinds of services that the state could help school districts in controlling their cost drivers, insurance being one of the major cost drivers, the way we can do that is by pooling all of the employees and having the competition be between the providers or the system providers and the pool. We look at that in a couple different ways. One might say that, there would only be one or two companies that might be able to bid on such a system. One or two might bid to try and have the entire statewide pool. On the other hand, the language in the bill actually encourages regional consortiums to come together to say, we in our area of the state can provide a better program for the people here, and we're going to enter into a consortium whereby we bid for this service, and the language allows the board, in fact, encourages that we look at those kinds of regional consortiums so that we're really trying to focus on cost, the benefits that are provided, and connecting best with the local region. So again, trying to get the best competition for the taxpayers of Oregon, because ultimately they're the ones that are funding the system, and having the state bring the buying power together to be able to leverage and have the competition then be between providers, not between school districts.
I have one further question, Mr. Sager. Does management, do the school districts support this concept?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, I would say that since the Oregon School Boards Association is opposed to it, I would not be able to speak for individual school board members or administrators. I would have to say that you'd have to have your conversations with those people as I have, and I don't want to try and second guess what the organization has discussed it with their membership. I don't feel appropriate.
We have a motion on the table to send SB 6398 to the full special budget, Senate Special Budget Committee, with a due pass recommendation. Seeing no additional hands.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I just want to say for the record that I absolutely, this is a courtesy vote on my part, and I absolutely do not support funding coming out of the Department of Education budget.
For the record, it will not come out of the Department of Education budget, but Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify with Senator Gordley. Is your sole objection to this bill because it takes money out of the general fund to start the program?
The Department of Ed.
That's a piece of my concern. My other concern is that there seem to be a host of assumptions about how successful implementation will be. I confess I don't have the intimacy of knowledge that you do, Senator Walker, or others who participated in the other hearings and who have knowledge of the studies that have taken place in Oregon. But it just, I'm trying to wrap my mind around implementation before something more in the way of a study has taken place. I'm not hearing enough about the studies that have taken place in Oregon and the assumptions behind the projected savings. I don't understand those assumptions,
okay.
Frankly.
It sounds like we need to get you some more information and make you feel more comfortable in knowing whether your decision today is a courtesy vote or really, really...
Additional information would be most helpful, and I'm sure that additional information would be helpful not only to myself as a member of this committee, but mm-hmm. to others in the body as well. I mean, I appreciate that, hearing that, you know, there are other states also doing studies and that Minnesota may be a little further along than the other three or four or mm-hmm. however many states are looking at this piece. But again, we're talking about assumptions behind projected savings, and I want to unpack those assumptions and better understand what it is we're talking about. And again, the Department of Education, you know, looking at the budget that we're faced with, I don't want to see that $5 million come out of pre-K or some other area of funding that is already on the table. So if the ending fund balance is a third way or third choice, look there.
With that, please call the roll.
Senator Gordley?
Reluctant, aye.
Senator
Johnson?
No.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitfield? No. Aye. Motion passes. I will carry the bill to the poll and make a recommendation to the chair of the committee that I and Senator Beckett carry it to the Senate floor.
If, Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify, the intent mm-hmm. is not to take any money out of the budget for the Department of Education. The intent was to either have it in the DAS budget or the Department of Education's budget in the governor's proposed budget, and that did not happen, so it likely would have to come out of the ending fund.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Okay. I will close the work session on 639A. And for the committee, tomorrow we will have the community college budget before the committee. We will have SB 300, and we will have SB 1053 back for a work session if the amendments are ready. And with that, we're adjourned.